Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this March 17th, 2022. Our first item of business is to take the roll of members. Mr. Dodge, take the roll.
Chair Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Representative Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Representative Barr.
Here.
Barr present. Representative Bernardi. Representative Bernardi. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick present. Representative Hausman.
Present.
Hausman present. Representative Heinrich. Representative Heinrich. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason present. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Nelson present. Representative Olson.
Present.
Olson present. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Richardson present. Representative Torkelson.
Torkelson present.
Torkelson present. Representative West.
Present.
West present. Representative Murphy.
Murphy present.
Murphy present. There is a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approval of the minutes from our March 15th meeting. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move the minutes of the March 15th meeting.
Minutes are moved. Is there discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a voice vote on this, members. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, members. We have three items on our agenda today. All three of these bills will be laid over for possible inclusion in a transportation omnibus bill. The first bill on the agenda is related to policy provisions and the Department of Public Safety. And this is a bill coming to us from Representative Cagle, House File 4212. Again, the motion is to lay over for possible inclusion. Representative Cagle, please tell us about House File 4212.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4212 is the DPS policy bill, and it has to do with license plate design and fee items, some dealer provisions, uses of school buses during emergency, and real ID proof of residency expansion. And with that brief description, I will hand it over to Director Zhang to give you the details.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cagle. Director Zhang, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pong Zhang, Director of the Driver and Vehicle Services Division. Thank you, Vice Chair Cagle. So this policy bill has a number of policy provisions related to DVS work, as well as one from State Patrol that I'll ask Lieutenant Rule to be recognized for to cover. The first is a technical correction to Minnesota Statute 168.1235, and it specifically adds disabled American veterans as a congressionally chartered veteran service organization. It's just a technical correction. DVS already issues a special plate emblem to DAV members, and we just would like that corrected in language. The second is an addition of language to clarify that for Gold Star special plates, that the applicant won't be charged for the additional $100 personalization fee. Again, another one where we already do not charge. We just want to clarify that language. And the third is a bill that adds internet as a utility for the purposes of real ID. And so we accept a number of utility documents already as one of the supporting documents to prove residency for real ID. We just ask that internet, which has been a commonly requested utility, be added to the list so that we can incorporate that into our real ID process, hopefully make this residency piece a little bit easier for some of the customers who struggle to find different documents in this space. And then lastly is a bill to make a few changes to the dealership licensure process. And so we seek to add explicit authority for the department to deny a dealer license in the case where there has been an intentional or negligent misrepresentation on the dealer application. And the second, the other half of that is to require the dealer to provide a minimum of 4 hours each week to be available for inspection. It still would be a surprise inspection, but this would allow us to make the most efficient use of both our time, the DVS time, and the dealership's time, so that they can be available for that complete inspection. And those cover the DVS portions of this policy proposal. And as previously mentioned, if we could, I'd ask that Lieutenant Rue be recognized to speak on the State Patrol portion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zhang. Before Lieutenant Rue comes to testify, I forgot to ask you, Vice Chair Cahill, do you have an author's amendment for this bill? Wanted to make sure that if you did, that we incorporate that.
Mr. Chair, there is an A1 amendment, and this just clarifies a couple pieces of language in the bill on line three. We're adding intentionally or negligently, so that, you know, a simple mistake isn't going to be the reason that somebody gets, you know, dinged for this. And then on page four, we are clarifying that some of these school bus drivers in emergency situations would be able to be compensated. And then also adding that when they're using the buses in an emergency capacity, that they are prohibited from using the stop arm and blinking lights. And maybe that's what the Department of Public Safety can speak to that a little bit.
Okay, well, I think we should incorporate your amendment just so that we have the bill in the shape you would like it us to consider. Sorry I didn't get to that earlier. Members, are there any questions or discussion to the A1 amendment? Let me scan here. I don't see any. So we will do a voice vote on this one. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed, the motion prevails. And so we will continue testimony on House File 4212 now as amended. And next up is Lieutenant Brian Rue. Please welcome to the committee and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members. Lieutenant Brian Rue with the State Patrol, Director of People Transportation. I'm speaking to Section 5 of the bill, and I want to appreciate Representative Cahill for carrying this for us. This portion of the bill simply, to us, seems like a common sense thing, but to allow for a school district or a contractor that doesn't necessarily have for-hire authority to use their vehicles to assist with an emergency evacuation of a community or an area, whether it's a train derailment with a hazmat spill or some sort of environmental hazard such as the floodings in Ely last year. There's certain provisions and statutes that did not allow for these vehicles to be used. And if they're sitting there and we need to get people out quickly, we felt it made sense to be allowed for them to do so. And I can stand for any other questions.
Thank you, Lieutenant Rue. Are there questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had that question about the buses as well. So did I understand that currently in law you are prohibited from using school buses? And this would be just an allowance to make sure that can happen. Is that correct?
Lieutenant Rue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg and members, correct. There are certain things in statute that would prohibit a district bus because it has tax-exempt registration solely for student transportation on it. It can't do for-hire stuff. And certain contractors that get the specific registration and rules within the Department of Ed that say what a school district can do. And I should point out we did work with the Department of Ed and MnDOT in drafting this language, and they were all in agreement of it. So hope that answers your question, sir.
Thank you, Lieutenant. A follow-up, Representative Peters?
Thank you. No, that one's good. I have another question on the bill itself when it's ready, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Let's just one last final call for questions for Lieutenant Rue. If anyone has those. Okay, well then to the bill, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question in regards to adding Real ID application, adding the information from utilities and internet, I think that makes sense. I have recently heard from a local constituent that had gone to local deputy register, and one of the things on the site said that you could bring in your property tax statement. And they were told by the deputy register that that is not one of them that they accept. So I was just clarifying, is that or is that not one? And you could certainly answer me offline. That's fine. I just want to make sure that that is still one of the items that's available for a Real ID compliance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg, it's a good question. I think it's always helpful to the public to know what forms of ID are acceptable and not. So for that particular one, Mr. Zhang, I think you would be the best to address that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, if I could, I will follow with you offline. I just want to confirm that. I don't want to misrepresent that, but certainly happy to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's check. Representative Elkins.
Just real quick to follow up on Representative Petersburg's question. When my wife and I did our Real IDs about 2 years ago, we discovered that there is some cases difficult for women to be able to produce some of these forms of identification because things like credit cards are frequently, even in this day and age, only has a husband's name on it. So things like utility bills or property tax statements are especially valuable on in that regard because they do almost always have both the husband and wife's name on.
Thank you for that clarification. And of course, no surprise that Representative Elkins would be very timely in getting his Real ID and documents in order. Let's see. If I don't see any other members with questions or comments, so
Representative West does.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. Representative West.
I just put it up there as you said it.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Proceed, Representative West.
I just have a question generally on, so changing the ability for the Real ID to take a internet bill, what latitude do we have as a state? Because I know there's federal requirements. What latitude do we have to change that in general, beyond just the internet bill? What can't we do to make it easier? Because it took me five trips to the dang DMV to get my Real ID. So I am all for making it easier. So what latitude do we have as a state to make that easier for people?
Good question, Representative West. Mr. Zhang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative West. So Minnesota rules dictates the documents that we can provide. Under federal regulation, the state, the jurisdiction has the authority to decide which documents are available. And so this addition will be within a utility would be in addition to the other documents already listed. If there are other documents that would like to be considered, we would be happy to provide thoughts on those. Certainly, the internet utility is one that we get a lot of requests for that we have to deny today because it's not available.
Representative West, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, so we have basically total latitude on what we choose to accept because I know, you know, there's a lot of federal requirements in regards to the Real ID. Can we come up with anything with their name on it just theoretically, or are there guidelines in writing on that?
Mr. Zhang.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, so I think total latitude would probably be too bold of a statement. I do, but I don't want to misspeak on what the parameters are. What's my understanding of our current authority is that for documents representing residency, that the state has authority on deciding which those are. I think there's some discretion that is involved in that. But I'm happy to clarify exactly what those guidelines are, and then share some thoughts on other documents that may be in that purview.
Thank you, Mr. Zhang. Okay, any other questions? Thank you, members, for your participation. Vice Chair Cagle, any thoughts you'd like to leave us with on House File 4212 as amended?
DPS policy bill.
Very straightforward, and I appreciate members' questions. So I'll renew my motion to lay over House File 4212 as amended. Thank you, Vice Chair Cagle. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 2682, Representative Murphy. We heard a bill related to NLX last year. I think there are a few updates this year, and so we will be hearing the bill and laying it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Murphy, tell us about the NLX passenger rail project.
Mr. Chair, I would, we have kind of an extensive agenda, and I think I would like to reserve my time for concluding remark in case somebody missed something that should be said. Other than that, this is the Northern Lights Express that would connect Duluth with the rest of the world, and or people coming to Duluth and visiting and then going back home. And it's a collaborative endeavor between states, between counties, between groups of people within the states and counties. And we have a wonderful film that's really short that tells it all. And but Commissioner Nelson is first on the agenda to speak then.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. So I think that we'll have testimony from Commissioner Nelson and then the video, correct?
Yes. I think maybe that's the way it is.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Nelson will inform us of the procedure here. Commissioner Nelson, it's wonderful to see you again. Welcome back. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is St. Louis County Commissioner Keith Nelson, and my address is Evelyn, Minnesota, 72251. Thank you, Chair Representative Hornstein, for hearing this bill today, and thank you, members, representatives of the committee. Also, before I forget, a very special thanks to Representative Murphy for her commitment to this endeavor and her leadership throughout. With that, I could talk about the fact that this real railroad project, because it is a real railroad project, and I want to say to all the members, I do support transit as well, but this is a real rail project between cities that I believe is going to have a tremendous impact on economic development. It could have an extensive impact on workforce development. And Chair Representative Hornstein, if I may talk about my greatest passion with this railroad, I personally live 60 miles from the closest point that this rail line is going to come to. But I understand for the people I represent in St. Louis County and all of the people of St. Louis County and our veterans, there's a long road that we drive on a daily basis to seek health care at the Minneapolis Veterans Hospital. This would provide the veterans along this line, some nearly 50,000 veterans along this line, almost 18,000 of them in St. Louis County alone, to be able to access health care without having to drive vans back and forth and back and forth, which I need to say to members of this committee, the average age of a van volunteer van driver for veterans is probably in their late 70s, early 80s. So this is something that's going to provide a number of opportunities. I believe this rail line has been fully vetted. I've been around it for the better part of 14, 15 years. And everything that you will read in the reports on this shows the viability of this line, the usership of this line. And again, some of those pieces that I pointed out where I believe that this will have a tremendous, tremendous impact. With that, I would turn it to, I don't know if we have Andrew Johnson on from Minneapolis or if we're going to the film, film at 11, Chair Hornstein.
Okay. Well, I think, it sounds like we should do the film and then we can proceed with Councilmember Johnson. Is that the preference here?
Let's go to the film, Mr. Chair, if we could.
Okay. Okay, our producer is in the studio, Mr. Howe, director, whatever his title is.
Ms. Palumbo may be controlling it. And I'm not sure that council member is on, so we should proceed it, and I'll let you know if I see that he's able to make it.
Okay.
Igniting imagination. The Northern Lights Express will provide high-performance intercity passenger rail service between Minneapolis and Duluth. As an alternative travel option, NLX will be safe, reliable, and frequent. Using the latest Amtrak equipment, NLX will provide 4 round trips per day, topping speeds of 90 miles per hour, getting you from the Twin Ports to the Twin Cities in 2.5 hours. With stops in 6 cities, including Minneapolis, Coon Rapids, Cambridge, Hinckley, Superior, and Duluth, travel will be more comfortable and convenient to get to college, work, medical appointments, family gatherings, and getaways.
Northern Lights Express is beneficial because it allows students like me to be able to access transportation north to south of Minnesota very easily, rather than owning a car, rather than riding the bus.
Once at your destination, you'll have connections to a wide range of transit options, including light rail, bus lines, and bike trails. A recent study found 88% of those surveyed are in favor of Northern Lights Express, with nearly as many supporting the use of state funding to make it a reality. If Minnesota invests $85 million, we'll be eligible for up to 80% federal funding or more than $340 million to build NLX now. Improvements made to the existing tracks for safety, reliability, and capacity will also benefit the movement of freight, adding efficiency to our nation's supply chain.
You know, any project that modernizes and improves the Grassy Point Railroad Bridge essentially improves the reliability of the transportation network in this region.
The Northern Lights Express is shovel ready and is estimated to create approximately 3,000 new jobs during construction and an average of 500 jobs annually.
These are good jobs, good paying jobs for building trades, for transportation, and jobs that support all Minnesota families.
From concerts to sporting events, NLX will also foster tourism activity with an estimated revenue of $400 million over a 40-year period. Connecting people and places, Northern Lights Express is ready to go with your support. Contact your elected officials.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Nelson, for your testimony and for that film. I have several other testifiers, and if they're on the call, please dial in and state your name for the record. Our first testifier is Aiden Hansen, a student at UMD and a resident of Andover, Minnesota.
Hi, thank you, Chair. I am here.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
I am Aiden Hansen.
Proceed.
Hi, guys. I am Aiden Hansen, a resident of Andover, Minnesota, and a current student at the University of Minnesota Duluth, speaking in favor of the NLX project. Before I start, I would like to give some thanks. First, I would like to thank Chair Hornstein for hearing this legislation in front of the committee, and I would like to thank Representative Murphy for carrying the bill. And at this time, NLX is asking for an $85 million investment to unlock more than $325 million in federal funding to complete the project for the benefit of the Twin Cities metro area, Twin Ports area, Greater Minnesota, and all of Minnesota in general. This project has won support from businesses, labor, colleges, corridor cities, students, veterans, and many, many more. And as a student at UMD, saving money is one of my top priorities. So to cut costs, I choose not to own a car. As well as being a student, I'm also a resident of Andover, meaning I take the trip up and down 35W over 20 times a year. Currently, my only two options are carpooling and riding the bus. There have been times when I don't have the ride from the carpool and must take the three plus hour bus ride back home, which is not always welcome. For a little more than a bus ticket, NLX supplies students like myself the opportunity for cheap, safe, reliable, and fast travel throughout the entire year. But it's not just me. I know at least 20 students from Andover that live in Duluth right now. There are several thousands of students at UMD alone that could benefit from this project, and that's not including the other three universities, St. Scholastica, University of Wisconsin-Superior, and Lake Superior Community College, which will all benefit greatly from this legislation. Think of their parents, grandparents, visiting their children, and grandchildren for music or sporting events. This is why I support NLX, to improve transportation options for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hansen. And members, if you have questions of any of our testifiers, we'll hold them till the end of the public testimony, and then you can ask. Our next testifier is Evan Vogel, city administrator from the city of Cambridge. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Harnstein. My name is Evan Vogel. I'm the city administrator for the city of Cambridge and have been here since October of 2020. First off, I'd like to thank Representative Hornstein and this committee for hearing this proposed legislation and to Representative Murphy for being one of its authors. House File 2682 presents an opportunity to leverage state assets to access significant federal dollars for an innovative commuter passenger rail project here in Minnesota. The city of Cambridge is slated to be the second stop north between Minneapolis and Duluth, and I am honored to have the opportunity to be here and to explain how this project would benefit the city of Cambridge and the surrounding area. While this rail line would undoubtedly benefit statewide tourism and provide a more environmentally friendly mode of transportation, it is the day-to-day commuter implications, both to and from Cambridge, that I am most excited about. Area residents would be able to park at the depot and commute to Minneapolis within 45 minutes. For a little perspective, for 3 years I lived in Representative Mason's district in Eagan and would take a Minnesota Valley Transit Authority bus into downtown St. Paul, and that trip was also approximately 40 minutes. And what I mean to say by that is that this train would provide the residents of Cambridge the ability to live in Greater Minnesota and easily commute into the metro area for work on a daily basis. The city is also adding a number of job opportunities with a newly announced state-of-the-art hospital and clinic, as well as new opportunities in manufacturing and commercial business. NLX would provide these employers a wider pool of potential employees who could use it as transportation into the city. Additionally, this project would provide tremendous value to our veterans who would have better access to the VA, to seniors and people with disabilities, as well as students who may be unable to drive or may not have access to other modes of transportation. At its core, this project provides three things: opportunity, equity, and reliability. It provides opportunities for any passenger who may use the train for commute, tourism, or recreation. It provides opportunity for each community that is a stop along the way and those communities that surround the depots to embrace the state-of-the-art amenity for residents and tourists alike. Here in Cambridge, we would explore opportunities for collaboration with regional bus lines, rental bicycles, scooters, and cars to help connect users with other opportunities in the region. It provides equity by enabling those with limited access to transportation or those in need of access to services the opportunity to more easily access those services. And it provides reliability by running on established track on a regular schedule to a network of other mass transit options. Given the availability of federal funding right now, it seems like this is the time to act. This project would provide tremendous benefit for the region and the state at large. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I encourage all members to continue to support House File 2682.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Vogel. I don't see Councilmember Johnson, but I will ask one more time if he's available. but he does not appear to be. But if he does stop in, we'll hear his testimony. I also wanted to call members' attention in your packets, or there was additional written testimony from Joel Smith, the president and business manager of the Laborers International Union of North America. So Mr. Smith is on the record as well. Members, before we get into discussion of the bill, are there any questions of either the author, but primarily at this point, our testifiers?
Chair Representative Hornstein, we do have Bob Mansleen available, as well as others, to answer any technical questions which you may have.
Bob Mansleen is available, as well as Frank Letterly from MnDOT. So if you have questions of a technical nature, they are on the call. Okay, members, I see a couple of hands up, three already. So we'll start with Representative Petersburg, then Representative Torkelson, and Representative Barr. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and I think we're just talking to the testifiers right now, right? So my question is to the person from Cambridge. I've been hearing that there has been, over the past years, some bottleneck with the railroads and blocking roads in the Cambridge area itself, and some that are concerned about how this might impact them. Can you shed any light on that?
Mr. Vogel.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. The short answer is I defer a little bit to the technical advisors here for that, as I'm new to both this position and to the project somewhat. I can tell you that with a 95 widening project, the rail switch, which is the primary cause of congestion along Highway 95, is going to be moved south as a part of that highway expansion. And we also have a separate bonding request trying to move that switch a little bit further down. That's on the Senate side. Regardless, where the problem comes in for the city is the propane refueling. When they come through, if they are crossing, they have to make 8 crosses back and forth. Because of work directly with Federated Propane, we have dramatically reduced the amount of stoppage that exists along Highway 95 at the rail crossing.
Representative Petersburg, thank you, Mr. Vogel. Representative Petersburg, I can call on Mr. Letterly or Mr. Mansleen, if you would like, on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's not necessarily. I'm just curious about that, and it sounds like they're working on the problem and aware of it, because I think a lot of people are concerned about that. And I will leave other questions for later and for my other colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is the time when we want to go into things like cost estimates and ridership estimates, or if you want to do that later.
I'll tell you what, Representative Torkelson, you know, we've heard the public testimony, and I think let's just open this up for broader conversation. And if your question does involve one of the testifiers, you can direct it to one of the testifiers, you can direct it to the author. We also have, again, some of the technical folks on the call. So at this point, members, let's get your questions on the record, and we'll have the author and the testifiers answer them. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would start with the cost estimate. The current number I see is $425 million. That's actually down from an earlier estimate. I don't know who I should direct my question to. Perhaps we should start with the author as to whether this cost estimate is believed to be adequate. And if it proves to be inadequate, who will be on the hook for the extra money that will be due?
Questions regarding cost, Representative Murphy, and if you want to defer to any testifiers, that would be good as well. Representative Murphy.
I wonder, Mr. Letterly is the person that I would ask that question of, because he's worked directly with the Amtrak people.
Mr. Letterly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Frank Letterly. I work for the Minnesota Department of Transportation as the supervisor for freight and rail planning. And I've been the project manager for the NLX project for the last 8 years. With respect to the capital cost estimate, Our earlier estimates included the purchase of equipment special to Minnesota and the construction of a maintenance facility to service those vehicles, similar to what we have in Big Lake for North Star. When we were doing this, the environmental assessment and the service development plan, we needed to address what I would call the worst case situation, in which we would be having to purchase all of this equipment. With Amtrak as our provider, Amtrak will be providing the equipment. Amtrak will be maintaining the equipment. The difference in the previous cost estimates that you've heard and the cost estimate we have now is the elimination of over $100 million that would have been required for equipment in the maintenance facility. As to the adequacy of the cost estimate, we do have to admit that it's been a couple of years now since we've done the cost estimate. It certainly would be, we've been doing our best to expand using inflation factors. The capital cost is intended to provide track capacity improvements to ensure that the passenger train can operate reliably and on schedule without interfering with freight trains. It's also intended to upgrade grade crossings to ensure that each grade crossing, particularly rural grade crossings where there's low volume today, that each grade crossing would have flashers and gates to protect the driving public. The capital cost includes upgrading stations in Duluth and in at Target Field, and building new stations in Superior, Cambridge, and Hinckley, and in Coon Rapids. So we did our cost estimates in such a way that we have a lot of contingency. If we move forward with this project, there are opportunities to work within the budget to make sure that we are not coming back for more money.
Representative Torkelson, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of follow-ups. First, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Grassy Point Swing Bridge. Does your cost estimate include the upgrade of that bridge, and what is the price tag on that one portion of the project?
Mr. Letterly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the cost estimate for the upgrade of the Grassy Point Bridge is intended to address the ability of the bridge to efficiently open and close. We had included a $17 million estimate in our cost, in our overall cost estimate, essentially as a placeholder, because we did not do a lot of initial investigation of that bridge, but it is included in the $425. But basically, yes, the answer to your question is it's included.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lurley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we could spend a lot of time talking about just the money side of this. I will just leave it with a remark, Mr. Chair. We've seen recently what cost overruns look like on other rail projects, and I'm very concerned that this cost estimate is way under what it's actually going to cost to upgrade these tracks and rehabilitate points like the Grassy Point Swing Bridge. I've got other questions, but I think I'll leave it to other members. I see their other hands up, and I'm sure they'll cover some of the things that I'm interested in. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for entertaining my question.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Just an announcement of general interest. We want to, you know, thoroughly vet this bill. I know there's a lot of interest in the committee and the public. It is my intention that we'll at least start. We have another pretty big and complicated bill today as well from Representative Elkins related to driver and vehicle services updates and reforms. And so we want to get to that, at least the public testimony for that bill. So I just wanted to, again, members, we'll take your questions. We'll thoroughly vet this. But if members and testifiers can keep questions and answers moving along quickly, that would help. With that, Representative Barr, and then we'll have Representative Koznick and then back to Petersburg. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a ton of comments, but in the interest of time, I'll save some of those. If all else fails, I'll save them for the floor where I can ramble on ad nauseum about how much I dislike this.
Representative Barr, we'll have opportunity today if people want to make comments. So, again, it's my...
But I do have one question, Mr. Chair.
Well, go ahead, Representative Barr.
It would be for, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, and I don't have it written down in front of me. The MnDOT gentleman, DOT.
Federally, that's Mr.
My question is, who actually owns the rail that we're investing taxpayer dollars in? Is this a private rail company, Burlington Northern or something like that, one of the bigger interstate rail companies that we're going to use taxpayer dollars to upgrade their rails? I'm just curious about the ownership portion.
Mr. Letterly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, the entire route is on track, owned by BNSF Railway. And the assumption is that in exchange for the improvement of track, that we would be given the right to operate our passenger train using Amtrak.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You said assumption, so there's no pre-contract signed or anything like that yet?
Mr. Letterly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, we will have to have some sort of agreement with BNSF before we could proceed with their improvements. But no, it is not in place yet.
Representative
Barr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll save the remainder of my comments for later.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to get up on my laptop here in St. Paul, but work off my phone, so I apologize about that. Representative Barr brought up some good points of a number of assumptions. Same with Representative Torkelson in terms of the cost to prepare the particular bridge and that, and that's concerning. My question is for the author. Who will pay the operating losses on this endeavor?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that we are planning on having any operating losses. This is also, if you keep in mind what you heard in the testimony before and what you've heard, this is a freight rail line. And it's very important. Freight rail is very important to the Duluth Harbor and the Superior Harbors. And the freight line has to be in tip-top running order at all times. In addition to the freight line, we are asking for funding for an Amtrak passenger rail service. So I don't believe that we have an estimate on losses, operating losses.
Representative Koznick.
Maybe I need a little clarification from the author's answer. I thought I heard that they don't anticipate any losses, but then I also thought I heard they don't have an estimate on any losses. So is it the plan that this will be a self-sufficient line and incur no operating losses, or they just haven't figured out how much the losses potentially could be?
Mr. Letterly.
Mr. Koznick, we're going to have Mr. Letterly respond to that.
Thank you.
Mr. Letterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Koznick. The Northern Lights Express service would be operated by Amtrak under their program called State Supported Trains. And if there's an operating subsidy necessary, then yes, it would be the responsibility of the state of Minnesota. I'm going to toss it over to Bob Manzoline. I think that we have some initial estimates on the operating subsidy, but I want to emphasize that there are a couple of things that are going to affect that. One is the ridership. We firmly believe that we have a very firm ridership number, but we also have the opportunity to apply for a federal to cover the cost of operating costs of the operating cost subsidy for 6 years as part of the bipartisan infrastructure law. So we would be covering the initial operating subsidy with a federal grant until the service is established and we have a better idea of how well we're doing with the ridership. But I'd like to pass it over to Bob on the operating subsidy.
Yeah, if we could find out how much you anticipate to lose each year, whether I don't care who pays for it.
Mr. Manzoline, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and we'll continue with our conversation with Representative Koznick. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Manzoline with the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Rail Authority. In response to the question, Mr. Chair and Representative, right now with Amtrak, the most likely operator of the service, we're projecting a ridership annual beginning in the first year between 700 and 750,000 riders. When it's fully operational in year 2040, the ridership is estimated right around 950,000 riders. The annual operating cost first year, again, is $18.9 million. That's what it's going to cost to operate. Our fare box recovery will be in the 70% range, meaning we'll have an operating deficit of about $6.9 million. And that amount would have to be paid by the state.
Thank you, Mr. Manzoline. If you have one more follow-up, Representative Koznick, we can entertain that. Otherwise,
yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think the gentleman cut out, but I think he said 6.9 million operating loss is what's projected, and it's just an amazing priority that this is a priority for the Transportation Committee or that my colleagues across the aisle, Democrats. We are looking at, and we just passed, the Senate passed an audit of the Southwest Light Rail because it's nearly triple the cost, 4 years behind schedule. We've been talking about mothballing North Star, which has never lived up to its ridership estimates and is bleeding money immensely. The governor has $200 million in his supplemental budget, and maybe it went up today again, with his supplemental budget for a blue line extension. And this love affair with trains is just amazing that this is a priority for our transportation in our state when we have bridges in poor conditions, when we have roads, highway infrastructure that is behind. We have all these other transit projects that bus lines that are desired across the aisle by my friends. And so it's just amazing to me, Mr. Chair, and I just have to put it on the record that we need to get our priorities in transportation straight. And, we're looking at adding a line here with this project of almost $7 million operating losses with an incredible estimate of a 70% fare recovery is amazing because nowhere in any of our lines do we have that, not even our bus lines. And so the numbers have got some severe fuzzy math, and it's almost embarrassing that this is a priority of the DFL. We have heard this bill last time. I don't care if there's federal money chasing it. We're being asked to spend good taxpayer money to chase some federal dollars so that we can lose more taxpayer state taxpayer money. I don't think the taxpayer should be on the hook. I would suggest to the author to put in, and we will have an amendment that I hope would be considered a friendly amendment. If you do decide to put this in your omnibus pack project, it would amaze me if you did. But the state should not be in the operating, in the business of operating these. The counties and the cities that want this train to a casino should be willing to pony up the operating losses if the state even decided to help build the capital cost on this. But absolutely, the operating losses should not be the cost of the state. And that is my statement, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to kind of follow up with what Representative Kosnick talked about. And that is that, you know, I think we all understand that various regions of the state and various people have different priorities for what needs to be done. And that's part of who we are as being part of the big state. And we have to figure out how we prioritize limited funds. But I think we also have to admit that we really also need to be very straightforward and open with some of our past performance and predictions. And when you look at farebox recovery and ridership information, I'm not aware, and I could be wrong, so I'll admit that, but I'm not aware of any projection when a plan or a project was in the initial stages in which the farebox recovery and or the ridership came anywhere close to being what was presented. And so one question that I have is, so what makes this different? I mean, 63% ridership and farebox recovery is basically unheard of in anything else at this point. And so what makes this project that much different, and how much confidence can we have understanding the past performance of these predictions? And I'll have a couple more follow-up questions after that, Mr. Chair. But does anybody have an answer for why we can be more confident with these numbers?
Representative Murphy, did you, this could be either for...
I had an interruption.
Okay. Well,
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think that might be for Mr. Letterly or Mr. Manzaline or any of the other supporters of the bill. Why, to paraphrase Representative Petersburg's question, why is this project different from other transit or even train projects in terms of the fare box recovery projection? Mr. Letterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg. Sorry. It's important to understand that what we're talking about is intercity passenger rail, and we're not talking about light rail transit or even commuter rail. North Star suffers from the problem that 95% of its ridership are people going downtown to work, and since nobody's going downtown to work, the ridership it suffers from that. But it's the fact that we are operating an intercity train that makes it so different. The service, the Amtrak service between Chicago and Milwaukee, which is known as the Hiawatha, is nearly breaking even before the pandemic. I'm not sure what is happening right now, but before the pandemic, that service was operating at capacity and paying its operating costs. There are other services like the Downeaster, which connects Portland, Maine to Boston, that also achieve the very high farebox recovery ratio associated with intercity passenger rail. So yes, we're very confident in our projections. Personally, I managed the development of the ridership forecasts, and I did everything I could to make sure that we used very conservative assumptions. I feel confident that we're going to make at least the projections. And to give you an example of a situation and where we did meet projections, the original Blue Line Hiawatha LRT project, and I was one of the project managers on that, we forecast that there would be 20,000 riders per day 20 years after we opened the line. Hiawatha was carrying 30,000 people a day within 2 years. I was not associated with the Central Corridor or the Green Line, so I can't speak to those numbers. But I do know that the projects that I have been associated with, we have met our ridership projections, and we've stayed within our budget.
Representative Petersburg, how about we have one more follow-up, and then I'd like to get to Representative Olson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things that I heard you say is all these lines that you talk about were done pre-COVID in regards to ridership, and even your projections, you said, were done prior to 2019, if I heard you right. And we know that there has been a change in attitude about people going into major cities for work now that, you know, remote has become more of that issue. And so I think we need to understand that we may need to reevaluate those ridership numbers and not use those old ones. And so I would just caution you to reconsider rethinking about that and getting actual updated numbers from these other areas that you said are doing better in Fairbox. I'll leave it at that for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be, we talk about leveraging federal funds. You're looking at $300 million worth of federal dollars, which, you know, that's still taxpayer money. No matter which way you cut it, it's still us paying it. But my question is, if and when this project fails, looking at the situation like with the North Star, and I know we've, you know, maybe as you claim it is apples and oranges, but I just don't really see that, but maybe it is. If and when that fails, to mothball it, to get rid of it, are we going to have to pay that $300 million back to the federal government? You know, that's one of the biggest reasons why I hear we can't touch the North Star, because, oh no, we're going to have to buy out the federal government, all that money that they gave us. And so we just keep throwing money in a hole with it. So that would be my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds like that's probably for Mr. Letterly or Mr. Manzolini.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. I think that there is probably a likelihood that we would be in a similar situation, but I can't speak to the grant requirements in this new bipartisan infrastructure law yet, because the programs haven't been yet defined. But yes, that is a possibility.
Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a, you know, well, there's a lot that we don't know about this infrastructure package, so I appreciate that.
Okay, members, I know there may be some other comments from members, and we'll circle back to the author before we move on from this bill. So I know that I think both Representative Torgelson and Representative Petersburg referred to maybe having some additional comments, so this would be the opportunity to do that if you'd like. Otherwise, we can turn it back to Representative Murphy. Did either of you, Representative Petersburg?
Get myself unmuted here. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the discussion is worthy of us having. I think that there's going to be some push for people wanting to have this line put in place. I am concerned that we are in such a transition in regards to just transit and people's travel patterns, that we are a little bit uncertain about what's happening into the future. And so I would just caution us to be a little bit careful about using some projections and stuff based upon pre-COVID versus COVID until we actually get knowing what it's going to be at. And because of that, we also then have to be aware of after 5 years or 6 years in which all of a sudden the state is responsible for that, how that's going to play out into prioritizing those funds. And so it's a challenge, Mr. Chair, that you'll have to decide on your omnibus bill. But I've just cautioned that we need to be fiduciary. We need to be fiscally responsible. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And I'll give the last member word to Representative Torkelson, and then we'll move over to Representative Murphy for some final comments. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, you know, we've talked about mining, we've talked about ridership. I'd like to talk a little bit about operations. You know, running a slow freight trains and a fast passenger train on the same single track rail system, to me, sounds like it could be challenging. If Mr. Letterly could address who actually will make sure that this system runs efficiently and safely.
Mr. Letterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson. The capital cost estimate for track improvements are based upon an operational analysis that we conducted in cooperation with BNSF to identify those track elements that are required to allow the fast passenger train to catch up and pass the slower freight trains. You're correct that it's a single track railroad today. Freight trains operating on the line operate at a similar speed and so do not need to pass each other. But it's the very fact that we are doing the track improvements that makes it possible to operate a passenger train at up to 90 miles per hour in the same corridor as freight trains. The responsibility for making sure that happens is would go back to BNSF and Amtrak. BNSF dispatches the railroad out of their Fort Worth office. But again, the agreement that we would be developing with Amtrak and BNSF would be to identify those capital improvements, and we feel that we've done that sufficiently already, to allow the passenger train to move at its top speed throughout the corridor without affecting freight traffic. That was the basis of our analysis. That's the basis of our capital cost.
Thank you. A quick follow-up, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Letterly. It sounds like it's just one more challenge to putting together an effective project. We'll all be staying tuned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, members, for a good conversation and good questions. I'm going to hand it over to Representative Murphy for any closing thoughts and comments. And again, members, we're laying this bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Murphy.
Thank you very much. I've been holding my breath for part of the time, and I've been writing notes for the other part of the time. Keep in mind that this train is also a working train in the sense that people that get on it don't have to be looking out of the windows as we quickly pass by. They can work on the train. They can do their Wi-Fi or their games or their busy work that they have in their briefcases all the way to the Northland and go back that same day without a hotel bill. We hope they'll have the hotel bill, but maybe they won't. People can come from all over the state on this train and get on a boat that will take them to the New York Harbor at one time, starting 2 years from now. There are connections with this train for the people of Minnesota to go to New Orleans, to go to San Francisco, to go to South Carolina and Florida, to every part of the United States. We can hook northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin up with the world, not only in our commerce at the ports, but on the trains that carry freight and carry freight away from the ports down to other areas of the state. We can relieve some of the highway obstructions if this train is made available for the people's commerce. I know it sounds good to say all of the things that you said, but is this love of the train system any more than the love of the motorcycle system or any more than the car system or the SUV system? I don't know. I've only been on the Transportation Committee for this session and last session. But I knew when I was chairing the bonding bill of how many transportation lovers wanted more money put into transportation financing of all kinds, the roads, the bridges, and everything. And trains were part of that. And so let's go forward in the 21st century using 21st century numbers, not memories from the past. And remember, this is on freight rails. And we all on this committee have at one time or another expressed the need for freight trains. And so passenger trains can go, and let's go with them, and let's connect with the world.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Thank you to all the testifiers who came today. And again, we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Our next bill on the agenda, and just I will note for the record that this is House File 2682 that we are laying over. So thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Our final bill for today is coming to us from Representative Elkins, House File 4164. We will also be laying this over for possible inclusion. Members, just by way of introduction, we heard from Mr. King a couple of weeks ago. This bill embodies the recommendations of that independent review. I think what I would like to do today, and I know there'll be lots of questions on this one too, we'll do our best to get through everything today. However, members, what we should do at a minimum is have Representative Elkins briefly go over the bill, and then I want to make sure that our testifiers have the opportunity to testify today. And if we have time to discuss the bill, we'll do that. But again, Representative Elkins, if you can briefly go over the bill, and then we'll hear from, looks like about six people who have signed up to testify. Representative Elkins, welcome. And we will be, again, laying over your bill, House File 4164, but you have a DE1 amendment. So why don't we go straight to that, and you can explain the amendment, and we'll incorporate it into the bill. So that will become the bill.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, the DE amendment more closely aligns our version of the bill with the bill that has already been heard in the Senate. So I asked Mr. Burress to coordinate with his Senate counterpart, Alexis Spangl, and they identified, of course, the changes that were made by the Senate when they heard the bill. And we determined that they're all pretty much technical, clarifying language. And so I asked Mr. Burress to put all of those changes into this DE so that our bill would be as closely aligned with the Senate version as possible. And then he did also add a few clarifying changes of his own. So, of course, our bill will be slightly better than the Senate bill. But they will be very closely aligned so that when we do the sames and similars at the end of the session, there will be lots and lots of similars and very, very few differences. So,
well, Representative Elkins is already anticipating the conference committee, so that's thinking ahead. Members, is there discussion to the DE? One, and again, this will be a technical amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like us to consider it in. I do not see any hands up. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 All of those opposed, the motion prevails. And we now have House File 4164 as amended before us. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you noted, we have already heard the presentation of the independent expert review panel report at a previous meeting. So I'm not going to go all the way through it because there were 30 different recommendations in that report. It's extremely well written. It reads like a very well done legislative auditor report. And, you know, it's kind of an indictment of, you know, the whole process. And largely, you know, to a large degree, we're kind of one of the guilty parties ourselves because it shouldn't have taken us this long to get to this point. So over the last few years, we've had dramatic changes in this environment as a result of changing from MNLARS to the new MnDrive system. And the advent of Real ID, and both of those changes have resulted in a dramatic shift in the workload. We have, you know, as a result of the federal law, and as a result of decisions that we made in the design of how MnDrive was going to work, we've shifted a lot of the work from the back office to the front office. You know, into the deputy registrar offices without providing any additional compensation. And so the results have been somewhat predictable. We have seen deputy registrar offices like my own home office in Bloomington that was operated by the city drop out of the market because in Bloomington's case, we were losing over $350,000 a year. And so those transactions mostly are moving to the nearest county deputy registrar's office. And when I reached out to Hennepin County to find out what the property taxpayer subsidy to their DVS operations were, it was somewhere in the range of $2.5 to $3 million a year. So central to the reports in this are changes to the way that the operations are funded. It does include a cross subsidy, so to speak, from revenues that are currently coming into and being retained by DVS itself to help compensate the deputy registrars for the increased workload. There are recommended fee increases for transactions, especially things like DVS. And there would be a requirement that the deputy registrar offices, if they want to take advantage of the cross subsidy from DVS to the deputy registrars, would have to operate full service offices. So one of the kind of perverse incentives that we've created by letting the existing fee structure linger as long as we have is that we're seeing situations like was one that was described, I think it was Brainerd, I think we may have a testifier who sheds more light on this, but where a deputy registrar, for-profit deputy registrar gave up doing the driver's license portion of the business because it was unprofitable. And so the city picked up that the driver's license portion at property taxpayer expense, and leaving the existing deputy registrar only doing the relatively profitable vehicle registration functions. And now we have a situation where they're looking at the bill and saying, well, if you want to partake in this additional cross subsidy and this increased revenue, you have to be a full service office because the objective is to create more capacity at full service offices to be able to handle transactions like Real ID, where you recall the last time when we had a Real ID backlog or deadline looming. There were huge lines, long waits for people to get an appointment to be able to apply for and complete the application process for Real ID. And that capacity just isn't there right now. It would be good to, I'll wrap this up really quickly. So it would be good, by the way, to remind your constituents that the next Real ID deadline is coming up in May. So they should get their applications in right now. But we have, we're going to have some good testimony today, and I would like to get into that testimony.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. What we'll do is, for sure, I want to make sure that we have three deputy registrar of related direct deputy registrars and one from a couple from an association, and Mr. Benner. let's make sure we get those four in today. We have a couple from partners from the public sector, of course, our driver and vehicle services and business technology officer from the DNR. We may need to have you come back on Tuesday, but we'll do our best to get all of the testimony in today. So if folks keep it to 2 or 3 minutes, I think we can get everyone in. Kelly Davison is our first testifier, the Deputy Registrar's Business Owners Association. Ms. Davison, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members. It's been a long time. Good to see you all. My name is Kelly Davison, and I am the owner of the Prior Lake License Bureau, which has served my community since 1984. I'm here to address the Deputy Registrar's sustainability. I'd like to begin thanking Senators John Jasinski and Scott Newman, as well as Representatives Steve Elkins and Frank Hornstein, for their continued support and hard work over the years in looking for a solution that will help deputy registrars remain viable to serve our Minnesota citizens. We have tremendous gratitude for your care, concern, and understanding in this situation. Deputies absolutely appreciate the driver's license filing fee increase, as we are unable to cover our costs to process them in our new system. We also appreciate the independent expert review team's idea of DVS sharing revenue from mail-in and online transactions with deputy registrars to help offset the thousands of no-fee transactions and customer questions we handle every year. Pages 16 and 17 of the IER report acknowledges this. My office processed 21,122 no-fee transactions last year. I don't support the mandate that offices must become full-service driver's license agents to be included in the revenue sharing. The increased driver's license revenue sharing will not cover the expenses to build or modify offices, nor pay for the equipment required to adopt this mandate for many offices. I am a full-service driver's license agent, and driver's license makes up 10% of my office's operating revenue. Also, fees must be doubled for 8-year driver's license transactions, or we will be put further in debt than we are today. The legislature must address the root cause of the deputy deficits, which is the 43% shift of work from DVS to the deputies, with the implementation of MnLARS in 2017. MnDrive is even more time-consuming for deputies because we have to scan each document and attach it to the record. Deputies have gone from 30 to 39 data entry fields in the legacy system to a whopping 125 to 154 data fields in the MnDrive system for one title transaction. This is a 300% increase of data entry fields for the deputies. Motor vehicle constitutes 90% of the work in my office. 71% are titles. It has been 5 years without proper compensation for increased time and loss of revenue this transfer of work created. The legislature has heard private deputy office testify that they were forced to pull monies from retirement accounts, take second mortgages on their home, and take business loans to stay afloat. The Star and Tribune reported on 1/20/22 that in 2021, Hennepin County subsidized their offices $2.5 million, and that Washington County has had to transfer $500,000 to $1.5 million per year since the implementation of MnLARS to keep their deputies open. On 1/21/21, they reported that in 2020, the city of Bloomington subsidized their deputy office to a tune of $376,000 and has closed their office permanently. We must come up with a solution to stop these office closures. You need us. DVS needs the deputies, believe me. They tried to shut us down during COVID for 2 weeks, and they emailed us back in a week and said, get back to work, we need you, which is true. Also, because I can't afford to hire employees for the additional workload, my office has had to shorten our business hours by 10 hours per week with the implementation of MnLARS. And that additional time needed for processing work results and fewer transactions processed each day. This has a cost of $1,669,943 in lost revenue to DVS per month from my office alone. Multiply that by 12 months and 5 years to calculate the loss of tax dollars collected, and it is $100,196,580 from my office. Holy cats, that's a lot of money.
Ms. Davison, if you could wrap up, we have like
three more. I'm finishing. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Motor vehicle filing fees still need to be addressed, and I'm excited to get down to the bones of deputy sustainability with you to come up with a workable solution for deputy registrars, your constituents, and DVS. It'd be a win-win for all. Please stand with us so that we can hire more staff to provide better service to our communities and allow deputy registrars to get back on track to proper delivery of funds to DVS. Thank you so much for your attention to this critical matter.
Thank you so much for your testimony and your work, Ms. Davis.
Thank you.
We're going to skip down to Mr. Hurst and Mr. Benner, and then if we have time, hopefully Danny Vossen. So I'm going to ask again if testifiers can keep it as brief as possible so that everybody has a chance to testify. Mr. Hurst.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association, an association comprised of both public and private offices across the state. I'd like to start with just a quick primer on the current status across the state. Currently, there are 171 deputy registrar offices across the state. That is three fewer than there was last year. In the last year, we have lost three offices primarily due to the financial crisis that they have fallen under. And we fear that this is just the tip of the iceberg if nothing happens this session, unfortunately, to prop up these offices. I would like to just say that of the 171 offices, currently, 97 of them are public, meaning they are either a city or county operated office, and the remaining 74 are private offices. We have surveyed our offices statewide, and well over one half are projecting a loss this year, which is consistent with what they've experienced in the previous year. Another third are hoping to break even, and a very small percentage is thinking that they will eke out somewhat of a profit. Obviously, this cannot continue. And as I said, we are fearful more offices will simply shut down as a result. Certainly, public offices, cities and counties can rely on the good graces of their councils and county boards to be subsidized. That option is not available for our private offices. It's not fair. And all offices are subject to the same rules and conditions to be an operator. Let me make two quick comments regarding the bill that has been presented before you as amended. There are two primary concerns that we have. Number one, while we appreciate the increase in the driver's license filing fee, which is sorely needed, we do believe that the amount proposed is appropriate for a four-year credential. However, the legislation calls for extending these to 8 years. Quite honestly, the current filing fee for driver's license transactions is $8. If you advance that to make them an eight-year cycle, just basic math will tell you we're going to lose money long-term on this. Right now, a filing fee is the equivalent of $2 per year spread over 4 years. If you extend this out to 8 years, the proposed increase means we're getting less than $1.40 a year prorated. And we're staying even with the real ID by doubling it to 16 in this proposal if it goes to an eight-year term. So this definitely needs to be adjusted. Either keep it at 4 years or increase the proposed filing fee accordingly and proportionately so that we can survive with our business model. And I want to remind everyone that the only revenue that comes into deputy registrar offices are the filing fees that are attached to completed transactions. And if we are taking time answering phone calls, responding to emails, dealing with no-fee transactions, that's zero revenue coming in. Meanwhile, we have set and established expenses, labor, rent, security. It goes on and on and on. And in statute, it specifically says our filing fees must cover the cost of processing these transactions. The other thing that I want to mention real briefly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, is what was already touched on in, with this move to all offices becoming full service deputies. I want to clarify that what the distinction here is that while offices offer motor vehicle transaction in a full service capacity, roughly two-thirds of them are considered full service driver's license agents. The remaining third are limited driver's license agents. The difference is that a full service office for driver's licenses can offer renewals when your license expires, whereas a limited office only does change of name, change of address during the term of your license. I'll wrap up by just saying that we really need to address the clarification between full and limited, and I look forward to working with the committee and the author and you, Mr. Chairman, further as we hopefully finalize this issue once and for all for the benefit of our deputies and ultimately the citizens of the state. Thank you very much.
That is the goal. Very well said, Mr. Hurst. Members, we will go a minute or two over time. We want to just make sure that Mr. Benner has an opportunity to testify and Mr. Vossen. So, Mr. Benner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Benner. I'm a legislative representative with Ask Me Council 5. I'll be exceedingly brief. I believe the committee has received a letter sent to you last night, which hits more of our comments in greater detail. I'll just hit the high notes here. One, we definitely would first want to thank Mr. King, Ms. Albus, Ms. Hine, and Ms. Wise for their work. It is an exemplary piece of an exemplary report. We want to make sure that you all know that the security camera report is very important to our members because, and I don't know if this is the same for deputy registrars as it is for our folks in DVS exam stations, but people are getting increasingly hostile because we feel that we are being set up to fail and that we cannot accommodate the immense needs of our citizens. And unfortunately, what that means is we need increased security for our members, and that means accountability with security cameras. We are broadly supportive of the provisions to change practices within exam stations, as well as to move towards pre-approval for really any sort of transaction, as well as shifting things online. Anything that makes it easier for our members to get their jobs done faster. We would only have some concern if those efficiencies are used to eliminate positions because there is more than enough work that needs doing at this current moment. If they're being automated out of their jobs, they should have the opportunity to have some retraining or to shift to an equivalent position within the state so they can pick up all the slack that we have all over the place because everyone has a worker shortage right now. Next to lastly, we oppose the inclusion of third-party testing reports because, one, there was already a report in the OLA back in March of 2021 that evaluated third-party testing, and they did not include it as a list of recommendations. They just simply stated the pros and cons, and we feel that's enough for you guys to work off of without putting any more resources into it, as well as if you have any questions about our stance on third-party testing, I'm happy to talk about it offline. And then also, I just want to say that the interactions between the exam, or rather the license fees, and then creating a full-service provider full service provider account and then making any of those shifts. We are not inherently opposed to that. We know that DBS and deputy registrars need to work well together in order to meet the needs of the state. We just have to make sure the pie is big enough that we can all succeed in that, because right now, like I said before, we feel set up to fail. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Benner, and thank you for your work and your members' work in this area. So, members, we're just going to have one final testifier who's been waiting patiently, and then we'll have our public set. We're going to continue the hearing on Tuesday on this bill, but we want to get Danny Boston in. Mr. Boston, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, and you will be our last testifier for the day.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. My name is Donnie Volzen. I'm from Brainerd Deputy Registrar, a private run office up here. I'll cut to the chase here and skip a lot of what I was going to point out. I just want to remind you that 40% workload that has been thrust on the deputy registrars, in my opinion, that should be 40% more time and savings for DVS to focus on delivering titles and driver's license to our customers. Standing in line at a DMV office for hours is costly to both the taxpayer and the state. Filing fee increases would be minimal when one considers the inherent value of a taxpayer's time. Deputies have lost so many staff over the past three systems that have been integrated into our office. We need high enough fees for both driver's license and motor vehicle in order to hire and retain the quantity and professional quality of staff needed in order to sustain this process, coupled by the continual expansion of technology and legislative changes that now complicate this skill-demanding field. New technology, legislation, employees, and equipment all come at a price. I know this year's transportation bill is complex. Your job is in remedying this conundrum is difficult. But that said, I invite you to contact me at any time so I can better explain what I'm trying to accomplish here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the empathy, Mr. Boston. Members, what we're going to do here is, right before we adjourn, just a quick reminder. We want to hear from Mr. Zhang. We want to hear from Ms. Covey, from DPS and DNR, respectively. If the testifiers who completed their testimony can come back on Tuesday, we can have member questions of you. So we're going to get through the remainder of the testimony, questions of the author. We'll spend a few minutes right at the beginning of our hearing on Tuesday. We don't want to short shrift this issue. It's very, very important. So we're going to spend a little bit more time on Tuesday. And again, the bill will be laid over. And there is a lot of work that needs to go into this. This is just a very broad brush, Representative Elkins, that you've painted for us. And we're going to really look at it very closely and figure out what would go into the omnibus bill. If you have a very quick final statement, Representative Elkins, we'll hear that and we'll adjourn. Representative,
All I want to do is just to encourage members, if they have not yet read the report, to please do so to prepare for the discussion that we'll have on Tuesday. It really is worth reading. This is a complicated topic, and it is one that's part of our ongoing oversight responsibility. So the things you learn will fare you in good stead going forward as well.
Representative Elkins is giving everyone a homework assignment.
That's right.
To the deputy registrars that testified, to Mr. Benner, thank you very much. Thank you for your work. Everyone have a good weekend. We'll pick up where we left off first thing on Tuesday on this bill. We stand adjourned. Thank you, members.